Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm John Williams, filling in for Pamela Paul. This week, Tom Perata discusses the letters of the novelist Willa Cather.
She was a magazine editor and a world traveler and not this sort of pioneer lady with a bonnet.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Alexandra Starr discusses a big new history of the state of Florida.
Look at Florida, right? Our fourth most populous state. It has a diverse population. It also has a rapidly aging population. And as the 2000 election shows, it's a political behemoth.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Willa Cather is on a short list of this country's all-time great writers. Her novels included O Pioneers, My Antonia, and Death Comes for the Archbishop. Now there's a volume of her selected letters, edited by Andrew Jewell and Janice Stout. It's reviewed on our cover this week by another American novelist, best-selling and widely beloved, Tom Perata, who joins us from his house in Massachusetts to talk about it. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi, John. Glad to be here.
Let's start by maybe situating, in your mind, where Willa Cather fits into the sort of firmament of American literature.
That's something that I've always had a little trouble doing. I think she's a kind of a writer trapped between centuries. She was born in the 19th, but really wrote in the 20s and 30s were her great period. And so that makes her contemporary of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Faulkner. And yet she seems still to belong to the 19th because she writes so much about her pioneer past. And she seems so, you know, the pictures we have of her sort of make her seem like a dowdy figure from the distant past and not at all a sort of contemporary in the way Hemingway and Fitzgerald still kind of seem. So these letters are really wonderful for kind of fixing her in the actual time of her life. And, you know, her reaction to World War I, for example, is really fascinating to see. And it's quite different from the reactions of younger people like Hemingway and Fitzgerald. She really has a kind of old-fashioned, patriotic sense of the war. And a cousin of hers is killed, and she talks about the glorious news from France, and the glorious news is his death.
How old was she when the letters in the book start?
It starts when she's quite young, actually. She's still in high school, and, on the one hand, she seems incredibly sophisticated and smart, and she's a real outsider. She calls herself William Cather, M.D., when she's in high school, and, you know, you can imagine how badly she fit in a kind of small-town, rural life. And yet everyone seemed to accept her eccentricity and her refusal to fit in with kind of normal gender roles. I mean, she just somehow set herself apart from the world that she grew up in. And then the letters follow her all the way up into the 1940s.
And she grew up in Nebraska.
She grew up in a little town called Red Cloud, Nebraska. She went there when she was 8, went from a very verdant part of Virginia and was just shocked by the desolation of the plains. And she said she never really got over that. And I think a lot of, you know, kind of the key to her writing life is, you know, she flees Nebraska and moves eastward. And then at some point comes to turn back to Nebraska and kind of embrace the place that she fled and to see it with a kind of nostalgia, even though she fled in a kind of horror.
Did she turn back literally moving there, or did she just turn back in her work and sort of look back?
Just in her work. So she did travel back there, and I think a trip back to the Southwest, actually, rather than Nebraska, made her realize that she was a Westerner, that somehow the landscape had this deep hold on her. But she remained a New Yorker for her entire life. And that's another way in which I think our image of her is sort of at odds with her actual life, because she was a sophisticated New York literary woman. She was a magazine editor and a world traveler and not this sort of pioneer lady with a bonnet.
Right, standing on the empty plains. Now, the case with a lot of authors' correspondence, but particularly keenly maybe here, is that she didn't really want these letters seen, and you write in the review that this kind of colors your reaction to reading them.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just a sort of vague preference. It's something that appears repeatedly. Initial to say, please, this is confidential. Sometimes it's just to a particular correspondent, this is entirely personal and confidential. And other times it's just blanket statements, I don't want my letters quoted. She is very interested in sort of managing the way that people perceive her. So, for instance, the literary executor of a woman named Annie Fields wants to quote from her letters, and she gives a whole list of, you know, reasons why this shouldn't be, and one of which is I put on a certain kind of mask to deal with Mrs. Fields, who was this sort of patrician woman, and so Cather's like, that's not the real me. But she's also very worried about the truth of her personal and sexual life coming out.
Yeah, well, you write, though, that even at the time she was a teenager, there was a sort of frankness with which she wrote about her sexual preference. This is in the late 19th century. Is that frankness evident throughout the letters, or does it just sort of peek out here and there?
Yeah, no, it just pops out here and there. I think as she becomes a more public figure, she becomes much more careful about it. And there's one really astonishing letter where she talks with a kind of frankness to an old friend about a college classmate on whom she has this really intense crush. And it's a very erotic description. I mean, it's about it going for drives, but the way that she describes it is quite erotic. At some point, she seems to realize that she can't do that. I think when that is she goes to Pittsburgh and has basically a long-term affair with a woman named Isabel McClung. They share a room in Isabel's house. It's one of these, you know, what was called a Boston marriage at the time. People seem not to mind if two single women lived together, if they did it quietly. But then Isabel's family decided it was time for her to get married, and it was really a heartbreaking thing for Cather. And you know, you really feel like that frank, open person who'd written that earlier letter has become a much more guarded and wounded individual after that.
Right. And you say also in the review that the letters to Isabel and then to another woman named Edith Lewis, who is very close to Cather, there aren't many of those letters that did survive. Was that a case of they probably, you know, did a better job of fulfilling her wishes and destroying them so that they wouldn't be seen?
I think so. I think that must be the case. And very few letters exist to Edith and Isabel, and the ones that do seem quite matter-of-fact and unrevealing.
And there was no official hold-up to publishing the letters. It was just a matter of enough time passing? Or?
Well, that's actually, the legality of it is a little vague. I mean, she put it in her will very clearly, but I think the literary executorship has passed to something called the Cather Foundation, and the people who run it have decided that enough time has gone by that her wishes can be discounted in the interests of, you know, literary and historical interests. And I do think, you know, for readers, it's a real... people who care about her, it's very revealing, and it might lead to a big new biography being written that can quote from these letters. So for readers, I think it's a really good thing. But it is true that she didn't want us to read them, and so we have to accept the fact that we're, you know, violating the privacy of a dead person, and it's hard to know exactly how to feel about that.
So some intimate letters to certain people are missing, but who is she writing to throughout this book? Is it a great variety of correspondents, or are there certain people she wrote to a lot over the years?
Well, there are a lot of letters to family and friends from Red Cloud. So it's very nice to see, you know, the fact that she leaves that place, but she's always connected to it in some way, and she's a slightly different person when she writes back to those people. There are letters to a handful of literary friends, and then there's occasional letter to F. Scott Fitzgerald or Sinclair Lewis or Robert Frost that is also interesting to see.
Was she close personally with a lot of writers?
It seems not. And the book is sort of remarkable for how little she speaks about other writers. I mean, she's clearly like in a literary world in New York, and there's a lot of letters to her publishers. But none. It's not Kingsley Amis and Philip Larkin, where there's a sustained correspondence between two writers. In fact, this is also what makes it hard to locate Cather in the grand scheme of things is that she's kind of alone out there. I mean, she's in New York at a very busy time, but she's not in a literary crowd, and she keeps herself somewhat aloof from that. So she talks a lot about her career, but not that much about her writing, not in the self-conscious way of a Henry James thing.
Right. And let's talk about the style of the letters for just a second. In the review, you say that the writing in her novels is laconic, low-key, and deceptively lyrical. Are those some of the same traits you find in the letters?
You know, I think there's a certain continuity between the letters and her literary style. But, you know, what's amazing about reading the letters from 100 years ago is just how much people lived through them. I mean, her life is just documented, you know, on a almost daily basis, and you'll get letters that are just dashed off talking about the price of groceries or, you know, an itinerary of a trip through Europe. And then there are occasionally very thoughtful, revealing letters where she's sort of explaining some intense moment of transition in her life. So you kind of have to look at individual letters and sometimes feel like, oh, there's Cather the writer, and or there's Cather just the individual going about her life, because there are both of those things present in the book.
Lastly, Tom, let's talk about, for people who, I think pretty much everyone who would be listening to this knows Cather's name, but maybe not everyone is as familiar with her work, and she has a fairly large body of it. As a fan of her work, where would you suggest someone start, or what are some of your favorite books of hers for the people who want to explore past the letters?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, most people will know My Antonia and O Pioneers, two of the other short novels that I think are really lovely and interesting are A Lost Lady and The Professor's House. I think those are two novels from her sort of, she had a remarkable period of productivity in the 20s and 30s, and these are two books that came out of that I would recommend that are maybe less read at this point.
A little slightly overlooked. Thanks for taking the time, Tom. Appreciate it.
Oh, sure, John. I appreciate it.
That was Tom Parada, who reviews the selected letters of Willa Cather on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Contagious, Why Things Catch On by Jonah Berger, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam. I did that on purpose.
Oh, you did that on purpose. That's funny.
Start over. Okay. Hi, Sam. I'm just going to keep saying that even when Pamela starts. Hi, Sam.
So one of the big new books of the season is a memoir by Amanda Knox. It's called Waiting to be Heard, and it comes out next Tuesday, but there's also a lot of buzz early about it.
There is, as is usually the case with big books that are embargoed, that have what is known in the industry as a one-day laydown. Bookstores are forbidden to sell copies early. This book has gotten out a little bit early. And this is the long-awaited memoir by Amanda Knox, who is the American college student, former college student. She was convicted of murdering her roommate when she was a college student in Italy, and this case dates back to her arrest in 2007. Mm-hmm. She was later acquitted of that crime, but she did spend 4 years in prison.
Yeah, and the story of her acquittal was quite a drama.
It was, and we really haven't heard very much from Amanda Knox. I mean, if you were following the trial very closely, you would know that she testified in her own defense. She said that she had absolutely nothing to do with the murder of her roommate, that she happened to be at her boyfriend's house that night where they watched the movie Amelie and smoked pot and apparently read Harry Potter aloud in German.
What could be more innocent than Amelie and Harry Potter? She really...
Exactly. I mean, you can't make it up. So she writes about all of these things in her book, and this is a 463-page memoir. It is drawn largely from diaries that she kept while she was in prison, and she did work with a co-writer, but this is very much Amanda Knox's story of what happened in Italy and her very long struggle with the Italian justice system.
And it's an ongoing struggle, right?
It is. The latest development in the case was a real shock. In March, Italy's highest court overturned the decision of the appeals court that acquitted Amanda and her boyfriend after their original conviction. So in March, this court in Italy ordered a new trial that will happen sometime in the next year. Now, whether Amanda Knox will be extradited to Italy is...
More drama ahead, for sure.
Another question, yes. I mean, I think that most legal experts probably think that that will not happen.
Right. I know that a lot of times with embargoes, things get leaked early, but is this a case where the books will also start showing up on shelves a little early, like they do in New York sometimes ahead of other places? Or are they going to stick by that strict date next Tuesday?
Well, that was the big question. I mean, HarperCollins has orchestrated a very complicated and very high-profile media campaign. The first TV interview with Amanda Knox will air next week. Diane Sawyer, after God only knows what had to happen for Diane Sawyer to win that interview, but Amanda Knox chose Diane Sawyer to be her first interviewer, and that will air in prime time next Tuesday, April 30th, the day that the book is supposed to be published. So this is the first time that people are going to hear from Amanda Knox. And there was a lot of pressure on HarperCollins from bookstores to get the book out. Now that there's been so much press around the book and what's in it, it's been reviewed in many publications, including in the New York Times by Michi Kakatani this week. But HarperCollins has stayed the course and said, no, we are not going to let this book be published early. People are going to have to wait. And I think that's partly because they have to give Diane Sawyer some kind of exclusivity that she has essentially been promised by winning the first interview.
Because otherwise, it seems like once word is leaking and the reviews are out, it would seem it would benefit Harper to have the book out there, because I'm sure people are showing up at stores who don't, you know, follow the inside baseball of the publishing industry asking where it is. And so they may be losing out on some early sales.
They may be, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, they probably have some kind of contractual obligation with ABC not to release the book no matter what happens. But I think that once that interview runs, that's really when the tsunami of media coverage is going to begin. And I think that what happened in the case of J.C. Dugard, whose book was published by Simon & Schuster, and when she was interviewed by Diane Sawyer in prime time, the book immediately shot to number one on the bestseller list. It was a huge coup publicity-wise. So I think HarperCollins is still counting on that effect. And they're hoping that Amanda Knox will come off as a sympathetic figure, because I think the success of the book will really rise or fall on that question. Do people believe her? Do they find her sympathetic?
Right. It does seem destined to be a big bestseller.
I think so. I mean, it's HarperCollins paid $4 million for this book. I know that they are certainly counting on that. And there's a lot in this book. I mean, you have a very detailed account of what prison was like for Amanda Knox. She worked on her Italian. She wrote letters to her family and friends. She read Dostoevsky. You know,
that's
she,
a natural.
Of course. You know, she exhaustively describes, like, you know, what she was doing that night, what her life was like in Italy, and how, as she describes it, she was victimized by the justice system in Italy and by the prosecutors who decided very early on that she was part of the team of people who had committed this crime, and they refused to budge from that theory, even when, as Amanda Knox and her lawyers would say, the DNA evidence was discredited. There was very little of anything linking her to this crime, and the police never really determined a motive for the crime.
Right.
So, you know, when you read Amanda Knox's account of what happened, You know, I think that it'll be very easy for the reader to find a lot of sympathy.
Does the majority of the book sort of take place while she's in prison?
It does.
And it's her reflecting on things in prison?
When Amanda Knox was on trial, you know, she talked in detail about what happened that night and where she says that she was. But she really hasn't spoken in public about what it was like in prison and what she did there and her whole legal battles. So that, along with kind of the personal side of this, the effect that all of this has had on her family back in Seattle, the sacrifices they made to fund her legal defense, to live in Italy while she was there so that they could spend 2 hours a week talking to her when she was in prison, that is all very new. And you know, I think it should do quite well.
And readers will be able to judge for themselves in just a few days. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, John.
There's a big new book about Florida out. It's called Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State. It's by T.D. Allman, and it's reviewed for us this week by Alexandra Starr, a journalist and Emerson Fellow at the New America Foundation, who says that Allman's book is a take-no-prisoners account of an influential corner of the country. And I'm glad that she's here to talk about it. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
So you say that the book takes a very wide lens look at Florida. It goes from, as you say, the arrival of the conquistadors in the early 16th century to the killing of the African-American teenager Trayvon Martin in 2012. So does it sort of focus equally on all time periods, or is it weighted more towards the historical? How is it structured?
I would say that it's very focused on the Revolutionary War, Civil War period. Mm-hmm. And then the era that it maybe does not focus on in such intense detail is post the 1960s.
So people looking for a contemporary look at Florida, this isn't really, this is more for the historical record.
That's right. And his argument would be that without understanding the historical record, we cannot make sense of contemporary Florida. So this is a necessary corrective.
Right. And use the word corrective in the review as well. And so what is he correcting?
I mean, honestly, it starts from the conquistador period and all of the myths that were propagated in that era to, the group that really comes in for a lot of vitriol is, I guess you could say, like, heroes of American history. Mm-hmm. So Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams come in for a beating, quite frankly. And to be honest, it seems well-deserved. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's done his homework. He is, as I said in the review, he does not pull his punches. And what Andrew Jackson did in Florida was, quite frankly, you know, try to make it a white supremacist state. He's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jackson had his flaws and his, I guess, strengths as a president, but, you know, he did come from the South.
And so he's focusing on the time that he had in Florida rather than...
Yes, absolutely. And then when it comes to John Quincy Adams, the, I guess he would say, myth is that the United States purchased Florida from Spain. Mm-hmm. And that's actually incorrect. We seized it. Right. It's not the kind of thing you're going to learn in U.S. history books. But he would argue that the fact that we don't learn those facts mean that we end up, iniquities have persisted. I guess he would argue poor social and state planning persist because of these myths that have been propagated throughout time, and we still make part of the history that we pass on to the next generation.
Right. And he's saying also that there's a kind of, that there's maybe an even starker divide between the haves and the have-nots in Florida than in some other places of the country. Is that something that also has deep roots but also persists?
That's exactly right. I mean, Florida doesn't have an income tax. Mm-hmm. And there's spending on state schools as a proportion of per capita spending. So it's not, you know, just the gross number is the lowest in the country.
Really?
Yes. And Florida schools are known as being pretty bad. So he would argue that, you know, when you look at all of the corporate giveaways that Florida has a history of doing from the Civil War era to today. He has an amazing section on the creation of Disney World and how Walt Disney just got away with murder. I mean, it's kind of stunning. Everything he kind of pulled out of the state as he built that theme park, you know, he would argue that that is not a smart allocation of resources.
Right, that some of the biggest things in Florida have been sort of built on the backs of average citizens, and there's been a lot of corporate welfare. It seems like that's a big part of the book.
Precisely.
You say near the end of the review, you say that it's extremely timely and relevant. What do you mean by that? Why is it relevant now particularly?
Okay, so look at Florida, right? Our fourth most populous state. It has a diverse population. Mm-hmm. It also has a rapidly aging population. And as the 2000 election shows, it's a political behemoth. But those demographics, the diversity and rapidly aging, are what we're going to see nationwide or more broadly. And so we could argue that that state is a harbinger of issues that are going to bubble up more broadly over the next decades.
Right. And you also say that the book is offered up as a call to arms. Is there anything that, you know, obviously there's a lot of negativity in the book looking back at the history, but is there a sense that he gives of what could be done to fix things, or is it more just he's focusing on the history and doesn't get involved in what we might do today to kind of remedy some of what's going on in the state?
It's a history book, and it's a dense history. He ends it describing how something that drives him absolutely to distraction is that when passengers are driving to the beach, car passengers are driving to the beach, periodically they will have to wait because bridges are lifted to allow yachts to go underneath. And the fact that drivers aren't honking their horns and screaming and going crazy drives him nuts. I have obviously not spoken to him, but this is my guess. I think he would say that beginning to set the history straight is a necessary and first step. But there is sort of like a melancholy to the book. Mm-hmm. He has his heroes and he singles them out at the end. And these are people generally who were like part of the Native American resistance to mm-hmm. Jackson's forces. And he commends them for trying to make Florida better than it is. No, he does not sound a hopeful note, but maybe obviously he put a tremendous amount of work and it's well written and it's passionate. You know, I think he sees this as a call to arms, quite frankly. It's not a straight-up history. Anyone who's looking for a straight-up history is going to be surprised.
Because his voice is so subjective in it. It's not just a he's always making his own points along the way and judging what's happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. Thanks so much for coming in, Alexandra.
My pleasure.
That's Alexandra Starr, who this week reviews Finding Florida by T.D. Allman. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, John.
So what's new on the list this week?
It has been a pretty quiet week in bestseller land this week, actually. On the hardcover nonfiction list, there's just one new book, new at number two. It's called The Athena Doctrine by John Gerzema and Michael D'Antonio. It is more or less a business book. It argues that traditionally feminine traits like flexibility or empathy or honesty are more highly valued and actually help people succeed. I'm not sure what that says about us rigid, cold, deceitful men.
Right, including the two men who wrote the book.
Yeah, exactly. But okay, what they did, they polled like 64,000 people internationally around the world to get them to say what traits they valued and to rank them in terms of gender. And then they went out and they found that the traits that ranked as feminine traits were more highly valued. And then they looked for instances of that in action where they found those traits.
In workplaces.
Exactly, leading people to succeed in business or in government.
Great. And what about the fiction list?
There are three new titles on the fiction list this week. At number 13, Philip Kerr has a novel called A Man Without Breath. This is part of his Bernie Gunther series, which is set during Nazi Germany. And Bernie Gunther is a private detective at that time. Then at number five, Iris Johansson is on the list with a book called Taking Eve, part of her Eve Duncan series.
Who is Eve Duncan? Are these romances?
These are suspense novels. It's interesting you ask. Iris Johansson has written a lot of books. In the past 30 years, she's written some 90 books.
Wow.
And she started out as a writer of what's called category romances, which are these short series romances for Harlequin or that type of book.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first half of her career, that's all that she wrote. And sometimes she would write 7 books in 7 months. She would just churn them out.
Wow.
And about 15 years ago, she turned away from that towards suspense novels. And they always do have kind of a romance mm-hmm. element to them.
And they've been on the list many times, I'm sure.
She's a regular on the list. It's interesting. I went to her website, and she lists her favorite books, some of her favorite authors on the website. And there are the suspense novelists and romance novelists mm-hmm. that you would expect to find, Dean Koontz and Kay Hooper. Her son, Roy Johansson, who sometimes co-writes with her, he's one of her favorites. But she also listed Ayn Rand as a favorite, and that jumped right out at me as not what you would expect.
Was there any further explanation about why?
Not on the website there wasn't, but I wrote to her to ask her, what's up with that? And she said, Rand appeals to me on several levels. On literary grounds, I believe she's a superb storyteller, totally fascinating. On political grounds, I can embrace several of her ideas, but not all. Mm-hmm. I have a passion for personal freedom and independence. I'm not aware of a Randian influence in my work, but it may exist, she said. And actually, there might be more to this story if you hear me out. The number one book this week is also new on the list. It's by Nora Roberts, Whiskey Beach. J.D. Robb, who has 36 books to her name, who is really Nora Roberts.
Right, her pseudonym for her mysteries.
Exactly. She's got, some 200 books to her name, Nora Roberts does. So J.D. Robb, in her Eve Duncan series, not to be confused with Iris Johansson's Eve Dallas series, has a larger-than-life billionaire industrialist Superman-type character whose name is Rourke. Which is also, of course,
Howard Rourke from The Fountainhead.
The Superman protagonist of Ayn Rand's Fountainhead is named. Exactly.
Right.
So if you connect the dots, you can make the case that Iris Johansson is really Nora Roberts, who is also J.D. Robb, and that all of them are really the cryogenically preserved Ayn Rand.
Did you ask Iris about those connections?
I did not.
Did you ask her if she's ever been seen in the same room as Nora Roberts at the same time?
Those are the books that are new on the list this week.
Great. Thanks for stopping by, Greg.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. The podcast is produced by Jocelyn Gonzalez. I'm John Williams for The New York Times.